Well, it's great to be here today. I was an adjunct professor many, many years ago when the NYU Business School was downtown. I'm glad that you're up midtown or downtown now still, but not downtown. This is a lot better quarters than what I experienced a couple decades ago. My remarks today are going to focus on two areas. First, what's the outlook for economic activity, employment, and inflation? In particular, what are the areas of vulnerability that we should be most concerned about? And second, what does this outlook imply for monetary policy? As always, what I have to say will reflect my own views and opinions, not necessarily those of the Federal Open Market Committee or the Federal Reserve System. In my talk, I'll argue that the economic outlook has improved considerably. Despite this, though, we are still very far away from achieving our dual mandate of maximum sustainable employment and price stability. Faster progress towards these objectives would be very welcome and need not require an early change in the stance of monetary policy. However, I'll also focus on some issues with respect to inflation that I think bear careful monitoring. In particular, we need to keep a close watch on how households and businesses respond to commodity price pressures. The key issue here is whether the rise in commodity prices will unduly push up inflation expectations. Inflation expectations are well anchored today, and we intend to keep things that way. But a sustained rise in medium-term inflation expectations would represent a threat to our price stability mandate and would not be tolerated. Turning first to the economic outlook, the situation looks considerably brighter today than it did 6 months ago. On the activity side, a wide range of indicators show a broadening and strengthening of demand and production. For example, on the demand side, real personal consumption expenditures rose at a 4.1% annual rate during the fourth quarter. This is nearly double the rate during the first three quarters of 2010. Orders in production are following suit. For example, the Institute of Supply Management index for new orders climbed to 67.8 in January. That's the highest level since January 2004. The revival in activity, in turn, has been accompanied by improving confidence, both for consumers and business. For example, the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index rose to 77.5 in February. That's up more than 8 points from where it was 6 months earlier. In this respect, the 2.8% annualized rise in real GDP that we saw last quarter may understate the economy's forward momentum. That is because growth in the quarter was held back by a sharp slowing in the pace of inventory accumulation. The revival in demand, production, and confidence strongly suggests that we're much closer to establishing a virtuous circle in which rising demand generates more rapid income and employment growth, which in turn bolsters confidence and leads to further increases in spending. The only missing piece of the puzzle is the absence of strong payroll employment growth. We'll need to see sustained strong employment growth in order to be certain that the virtuous circle has become firmly established. With respect to the labor market, there are conflicting signals. On the one hand, the unemployment rate has fallen sharply over the last 2 months, dropping from 9.8% to 9% even. This is the biggest two-month drop in the unemployment rate since November 1958. On the other hand, payroll employment gains have remained very modest, rising at only 83,000 jobs per month over the last 3 months. Such modest payroll growth is not consistent with a sustained drop in the unemployment rate. The true story here undoubtedly lies somewhere in between, but probably more on the side of the household survey that tracks unemployment. That is because measured payroll employment growth in January was probably temporarily depressed by bad winter weather. Although some of the recent decline in employment is due to a drop in the number of people actively seeking work, the household survey does show a pickup in hiring. And other labor market indicators, such as initial claims and the employment components of the two ISM surveys, have also shown improvement recently. This suggests that the weakness in payroll growth is the outlier. Although there is some uncertainty over the timing and speed of the labor market recovery, I do expect that payroll employment growth will increase considerably more rapidly in coming months. We should welcome this. A substantial pickup growth there is needed. Even if we were to see growth of, say, 300,000 jobs per month, we would still have considerable slack in the labor market at the end of 2012. In monitoring employment trends, we also need to recognize that the data are likely to be quite noisy on a month-to-month basis. This is particularly the case during the winter months when weather can play an important role. I recall, for example, the bounce back following the 1996 blizzard in the Northeast, when the February payroll employment gain for that month was originally reported as plus 705,000. It will be important not to overreact to monthly data, but to focus on the underlying trend. So why is the economy finally showing more signs of life? In my view, this improvement reflects three developments. First, households and financial institution balance sheets continue to improve. On the household side, the savings rate, which moved up sharply in 2008 and 2009, now seems to have stabilized in a range of 5 to 6%. Meanwhile, debt service burdens have fallen sharply to levels that prevailed during the mid-1990s. Debt service has been pushed down by a combination of debt repayment, refinancing at lower interest rates, and debt write-offs. Financial institutions have strengthened their balance sheets through retained earnings and by issuing equity. For many larger institutions, a release of loan loss reserves has been important in supporting earnings. Credit availability has improved somewhat as very tight standards start to loosen. As a result, some measures of bank credit are finally beginning to expand again. Second, monetary policy and fiscal policy have provided support to recovery. On the monetary policy side, the unusually low level of short-term rates and the Federal Reserve's large-scale asset purchase program, which we refer to as LSAP, have fostered a sharp improvement in financial market conditions. Since August 2010, for example, when market participants began to anticipate that the Federal Reserve would initiate another LSAP program, U.S. equity prices have risen sharply and credit spreads have narrowed. Long-term interest rates have moved higher after initially declining, but this does not appear troublesome as it primarily reflects the improving economic outlook. On the fiscal side, the economy has been supported by a shift in policy towards near-term accommodation. In particular, the temporary reduction in payroll employment taxes is providing substantial support right now to disposable income and consumption. This could have a particularly strong impact on growth during the first half of this year. Third, growth abroad, especially among emerging market economies, has been strong, and this has led to an increase in the demand for U.S. goods and services. Over the four quarters of 2010, for example, real exports rose at over a 9% annual rate. And after a disappointing performance earlier in the year, U.S. net exports surged in the fourth quarter. The firming in economic activity, in short, is due both to a natural healing process following the financial crisis and past and present policy support. In this regard, it's important to emphasize that we did expect growth to strengthen. We provided additional monetary policy stimulus by the asset purchase program in order to help ensure that the recovery would regain momentum. We have been seeking a stronger recovery with more rapid progress to our dual mandate objectives. This is welcome and not a reason to reverse course. We also have to be careful not to be overly optimistic about the growth outlook. The coast is not completely clear. The healing process and the aftermath of the crisis takes time, and there are still several areas of vulnerability. In particular, housing activity remains unusually weak, and home prices have begun to soften again in many parts of the country. State and local government finances remain under stress, and this is likely to lead to further fiscal consolidations and job losses in this sector. This will offset at least a part of the federal fiscal stimulus. And we cannot rule out the possibility of further shocks from abroad, whether in the form of stress in sovereign debt markets or geopolitical events. Higher oil prices, for example, act as a tax on disposable income, and the situation in the Middle East remains uncertain and dynamic. Also, we cannot ignore the risks stemming from the longer-term fiscal challenges that we face in the United States. But in the near term, the most immediate domestic problems seem more likely to recede than become more prevalent. On the housing side, stronger employment growth should lead to increased household formation, which should provide more support to housing demand. And anxieties about the large overhang of unsold homes, represented by the foreclosure pipeline, may overstate the magnitude of the excess supply in housing. Families that have lost their homes through foreclosures are likely to seek new homes as their income permits, even though many may re-enter the housing market as renters rather than as buyers. On the state and local government side, a rising economy should boost sales and income tax revenue and help narrow near-term fiscal shortfalls. Moreover, although we do need to remain ever watchful for signs that low interest rates could foster a buildup of financial excesses or bubbles that might pose a medium-term risk to both full employment and price stability, currently, risk premium on U.S. financial assets do not appear unduly compressed. On the inflation side of the ledger, there are some signs that core inflation rates are now stabilizing. However, both headline and core inflation remains below levels consistent with the Fed's dual mandate objectives. Most members of the Fed consider this to be 2% or a bit less when measured by the personal consumption expenditures measure. Recent evidence shows that the large amount of slack in the economy has contributed to disinflation over the past couple of years. This can be seen in the steady decline in core inflation that we've seen since the middle of 2008 through the end of last year. For example, core personal consumption expenditure inflation in December was up only 0.7% from a year earlier. That's down from a 2.5% rate in mid-2008. Slack in our economy is still very large, and this will continue to be a factor that acts to dampen price pressures. Nevertheless, there are several reasons why we need to be careful about inflation, even in an environment of ample spare capacity. First, commodity prices have been rising rapidly. This has already increased headline inflation relative to core inflation. And the fact is that the commodity price changes that have already taken place will almost certainly continue to push up the headline inflation rate on a year-over-year basis for several months at least. Second, some of this pressure will feed into core inflation. And third, medium-term inflation expectations have risen recently back to levels consistent with our dual mandate objectives. If medium-term inflation expectations were to move significantly higher from here on a sustained basis, that would pose a risk to inflation and thus would have important implications for monetary policy. With respect to the inflation outlook, I think there are four important questions that deserve attention. First, how much slack is there in the economy? In other words, how fast can the economy grow for how long until the economy is close to full employment? Second, are there speed limit effects in terms of inflation? In other words, could inflation rise because the rate of economic growth was unusually high, even though plenty of slack remained in the economy? Third, given the emergence of economies such as China and India, can commodity price pressures be safely ignored as temporary noise in terms of the long-term inflation outlook, or are these pressures likely to prove persistent? If commodity price pressures persisted, this could undercut one rationale for focusing on core measures of inflation, namely the argument that core measures are better predictors of future headline inflation than today's headline inflation rate. And fourth, what can the Federal Reserve do to ensure that inflation expectations stay well anchored? With respect to the first question, the economy retains a very large amount of slack by virtually all measures. For example, last month the industrial capacity utilization rate was 76.1%. This is nearly 5 points below the long-term average. Similarly, the current unemployment rate of 9% is well above most estimates of the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, what economists refer to as NARU. That's the lowest rate of unemployment consistent with sustained price stability. In the pre-crisis period, the NARU was estimated to be in the region of about 4.5 to 5%. There are several reasons why the NARU may now be higher. First, extended unemployment compensation benefits create incentives for prospective workers to keep looking for better jobs rather than accept less attractive positions. Empirical work on this subject suggests that the NARU might currently be roughly 1 percentage point higher because of this factor. However, it's important to point out that this effect will only persist as long as the extended benefit programs is in place. Second, the rise in unemployment has been associated with an increase in the degree of mismatch between employed workers' job skills and available job vacancies. The Beveridge curve illustrates the relationship between unemployment and vacancies. Some cite the upward shift in this curve as evidence of greater mismatch. Third, the longer that people are unemployed, the more their skills tend to atrophy, which makes it harder for them to become employed in the future. For unemployed workers, the median duration of employment has climbed, and a growing share have been jobless for longer periods. In my view, these last two factors have probably pushed up the NARU by about a half to one percentage point on top of the one percentage point increase due from extended unemployment benefits, which of course is likely to be a temporary effect. Taken together, this suggests that the current NARU might be in a range of 6 to 7%. Although a rise in NARU like this is undesirable, this rise should not create a lot of concern about medium-term inflation prospects. First, even the higher estimate of NARU is still far below the current unemployment rate of 9%. Second, as I discussed earlier, much of this rise in the NARU is likely to be temporary rather than permanent. As the labor market improves, the extension of unemployment claims benefits will almost certainly be allowed to lapse. When this occurs, the NARU is likely to drop back down to somewhere in the region of 5 to 6%. Third, some of the increase that the NARU has increased is not particularly compelling. For example, the beverage cruise has a loop in it right now, but this loop has been evident in past business cycles, cycles in which there was no persistent increase in the NARU. This strongly suggests that the rise in job mismatch that we're seeing today has a cyclical component to it. And fourth, the 9% unemployment rate may actually understate the amount of labor market slack. That's because we've seen an unusually sharp drop in the labor participation rate during this cycle. So there's a lot of people that have given up looking for work, but they may actually re-enter the labor market when things start to improve. In my view, the large gap between the current unemployment rate and the long-run NARU suggests that there is a low payoff from investing much energy to more precisely estimate the NARU. Fact is, as the economy expands and the unemployment rate falls, we will have plenty of time to refine our estimate of NARU, and we'll be able to do that in light of what happens to labor cost trends such as the unemployment cost index and unit labor cost. Currently, all these measures are quiescent and consistent with a large amount of labor market slack. The second question is whether the economy could grow so fast that inflation pressures could rise even with an unemployment rate still well above the NARU. The notion is that at very fast growth rates, the wages and prices might have to rise in order to direct labor and capital to those areas where demand and output were rising particularly rapidly. Although this is a possibility that we shouldn't categorically rule out, we should not be too worried about this, particularly if growth is broadly based. In particular, the economy is not growing quickly right now relative to past recoveries. For example, in the rebound from the comparably deep recession of the early 1980s, the annualized growth rate in that recovery exceeded 7% for five consecutive quarters. Moreover, empirically, there's little historical evidence that discontinuous speed limit effects play a significant role in influencing inflation in the United States. The third issue is whether the rise in commodity prices will turn out to be persistent, and if so, how this might impact the inflation outlook. Recently, commodity prices have risen sharply. For example, the spot GSCI, which is a broad measure of commodity prices, has risen more than 35% over the past year. And this rise was in train before the recent upheavals in the Middle East raised market concerns about potential disruptions to oil supplies, which has pushed energy prices higher. Commodity price pressures are pushing measures of headline inflation above measures of core inflation, which exclude food and energy prices. How worried should policymakers be about this development? Although there have been commodity price cycles in the past, commodity prices have not consistently increased relative to other prices, and indeed have declined in relative terms over the very long term. Historically, if commodity prices were to rise sharply in a given year, it has been reasonable to expect that these prices would stabilize or fall within a year or two. This property has been important because it has meant that measures of current core inflation, rather than current headline inflation, have been more reliable in predicting future headline inflation rates. In contrast, over the past decade, commodity prices generally have been in an upward trend. For example, fuel prices have generally been rising since 1999, and non-fuel prices since 2001, although both trends were temporarily interrupted by the financial crisis. Setting to one side the near-term effects of geopolitical developments, I think the rapid urbanization and industrialization of nations such as China and India could be generating an ongoing secular rise in commodity prices that might not be fully captured by today's spot and future market prices. If this is the case, this would undercut the usefulness of core inflation as a good predictor of future headline inflation. Nevertheless, there are some important mitigating factors that suggest that it would be unwise for the Federal Reserve to overreact to recent commodity price pressures. First, despite the general uptrend that we've seen for some years, some of the recent commodity price pressures are likely to be temporary. In particular, much of the recent rise in food prices is due to a sharp drop in production caused by poor weather rather than from a surge in consumption. More typical weather and higher prices should generate a rise in production that should push prices somewhat lower. If you look at futures prices on a forward basis, that's what market participants expect. They expect that agricultural commodity prices will fall as we go from 2011 into 2012. Second, even if commodity price pressures were to prove persistent, the U.S. situation differs markedly from that of many other countries. Relative to most other major economies, the U.S. inflation rate is starting from a lower point, and the amount of slack is much greater. Moreover, for the United States, commodities represent a relatively small share of the consumption basket. This small share helps to explain why the pass-through of commodity prices into core measures of inflation has been very low in the U.S. for several decades. Third, the Federal Reserve's success in anchoring inflation expectations has also been important in limiting this commodity price pass-through into core inflation. Since 1984, for example, when the Federal Reserve began to achieve success in driving down and then subsequently anchoring long-term inflation expectations, there's been very little evidence of commodity price pass-through into core inflation. In contrast, prior to 1984, when inflation expectations were much less well anchored, pass-through did occur and at times played an important role in pushing underlying inflation higher. This leads to our final issue with respect to the inflation outlook, the importance of inflation expectations in shaping the inflation outlook. Rising inflation expectations tend to push inflation up in a number of ways, by reducing the expected cost of borrowing at a given level of interest rates, by pulling forward decisions to beat future expected price increases, and by encouraging more aggressive price and wage setting behavior. In a world of unanchored inflation expectations, commodity price pressures would more easily be passed through into core inflation. Fortunately, inflation expectations do remain well anchored. This can be seen in all three major measures of inflation expectations that we at the Fed keep a very close eye on. First, market-based measures of inflation expectations are generally well-behaved. For example, the five-year forward measure of break-even inflation that we generate from looking at the differences in Treasury nominal yields versus Treasury tip yields has shown a modest rise since mid-2010, but that's just taken us back into the range that generally has been in place for about a decade. Second, the long-term inflation expectations of professional forecasters have been very stable. The median long-term inflation forecast, for example, in the professional forecaster surveys remains at 2.1% for the PCE deflator. And in terms of household expectations, there has been an increase in short-term expectations. This is what typically occurs when commodities such as gasoline go up sharply in price. But even here, longer-term expectations remain well anchored. For example, the University of Michigan median five-year inflation expectation measure remains around 2.9%. This is comfortably within its normal range. And historically, this measure has been actually a bit higher than the actual realized inflation that actually occurs. So to summarize the main points, we have a considerable amount of slack. We have little evidence of discontinuous speed limit effects. We have little inflation pass-through from commodities into core inflation, as long as inflation expectations are well anchored. This suggests that the biggest risk in terms of higher underlying inflation over the next year or two is that inflation expectations could become unanchored. This might occur, for example, if there was a loss of confidence in the ability or the willingness of the Federal Reserve to tighten monetary policy in a timely way in order to keep inflation in check. In this regard, the proof of the pudding will be in our actions. Talk is cheap. What is key is that we take the appropriate policy steps in a timely manner. However, let me make two important points. First, I am very confident that the enlarged Federal Reserve balance sheet will not compromise our ability to tighten monetary policy when we need to, consistent with our dual mandate goals. Second, I am equally confident that no one on the FOMC is willing to countenance a sustained rise in either inflation expectations or inflation. So let me explain why our enlarged balance sheet does not compromise our ability to tighten monetary policy. Although our enlarged balance sheet has led to a sharp rise in excess reserves in the banking system, this has the potential to spur inflation only if banks lend these reserves out in a manner that generates a rapid expansion of credit and an associated sharp rise in economic activity. The ability of the Federal Reserve to pay interest on excess reserves, which we refer to as IOER, provides a means to prevent such excessive credit growth. Because the Federal Reserve is the safest of counterparties, the interest on excess reserves rate is effectively the risk-free rate. By raising that rate, the Federal Reserve can raise the cost of credit more generally. That is because banks will not lend at rates below the IOER rate when they can instead hold their excess reserves on deposit at the Fed and earn that risk-free rate. In that way, the Federal Reserve can drive up the rate at which banks are willing to lend to more risky borrowers. That can restrain the demand for credit and prevent credit from growing sufficiently rapidly to fuel an inflationary spiral. For this dynamic to work correctly, the Federal Reserve needs to set the IOER rate at a level consistent with the amount of required reserves, money supply, and credit outstanding needed to achieve its dual mandate of full employment and price stability. If the demand for credit were too high and that were to exceed what was appropriate, the Federal Reserve would raise the IOER rate. That would push up the federal funds rate and other short-term rates. That would tighten broader financial conditions and constrain the demand for credit. The demand, in contrast, for credit were insufficient to push the economy to full employment, then the Federal Reserve would reduce the IOER rate, pushing down the federal fund rate and other short-term rates to ease financial conditions and support demand, recognizing, of course, that we can't push the IOER rate down below zero. While the mechanism is different, using the federal funds rate or the IOER rate, the basic approach is very similar to the way the Federal Reserve has behaved historically. Now, although our ability to pay interest on excess reserves is sufficient to retain control of monetary policy, it's not a bad policy to have both a belt and suspenders in place. As a result, we've been developing the suspenders. We have developed a means of draining reserves to provide reassurance that we will not, under any circumstance, lose control of monetary policy. These include reverse repurchase agreements, transactions with dealers and other counterparties, auctions of term deposits for banks, and the ability of the Fed to sell securities from its portfolio. Now, a related concern is whether the Federal Reserve will be able to act sufficiently quickly once it determines that it's time to raise the interest on excess reserves rate. This concern reflects the view that the excess reserves sitting on banks' balance sheets are essentially dry tinder that could quickly fuel excessive credit creation and put the Fed behind the curve in tightening monetary policy. In terms of imagery, this concern seems compelling. The banks sitting on piles of money that could be used to extend credit at a moment's notice. However, this reasoning ignores a very, very important point. Banks have always had the ability to expand credit whenever they like. They don't need a pile of dry tinder in the form of excess reserves to do so. That's because the Federal Reserve's standard operating procedure for several decades has been a commitment to supply sufficient reserves to keep the federal funds rate at its target. If banks wanted to expand credit, that would drive up the demand for reserves. The Federal Reserve would automatically meet that demand by supplying additional reserves as needed to maintain the federal funds rate at its target's rate. In terms of the ability to expand credit rapidly, it makes no difference whether the banks have lots of excess reserves on their own balance sheets or can source whatever reserves they need from the federal funds market at the federal funds rate. So, we have the means to tighten monetary policy when the time comes, but do we have the will? I think there should be no doubt about this. It is well understood among all members of the FOMC that allowing inflation to gain a foothold is a losing game with large costs and few, if any, benefits. In this regard, some have argued that Fed officials might be reluctant to raise short-term rates because such increases would squeeze the net interest margin the Fed earns on its portfolio of securities. Although it's true that a rise in short-term rates would reduce the Fed's net income from the extraordinarily high levels we've seen in 2009 and 2010, I can assure you this will not play a significant or meaningful role in the Fed's monetary policy deliberations. Fed policy is driven by objectives set out in the dual mandate, and the net income earned by the Fed is a consequence of those policy choices that advance those objectives. The Federal Reserve's net income statement does not drive or constrain our policy actions. In short, we act as a central bank. We are not a investment manager. It's also worth pointing out in passing that a failure to raise short-term interest rates at an appropriate moment based on our dual mandate objectives would also be a losing strategy with respect to net income. Inflation would climb, bond yields would rise, and the Federal Reserve ultimately would be forced to raise short-term rates more aggressively or to sell more assets at lower prices in order to regain control of inflation. This would almost certainly result in larger reductions in net income than a timelier exit from the current stance of monetary policy. So what does all this apply for monetary policy? First, barring a sustained period of economic growth so strong that the economy's substantial excess slack is quickly exhausted, or a noteworthy rise in inflation expectation, the outlook implies that short-term interest rates are likely to remain unusually low for an extended period. The economy can be allowed to grow rapidly for quite some time before there is a real risk that shrinking slack will result in a rise in underlying inflation. We will learn more as we go, and as always, should be prepared to adjust course in a timely manner if incoming information suggests that a different strategy would better promote our objectives. Second, the Federal Reserve needs to continue to communicate effectively about its objectives. The efficacy of the tools that it has at its disposal to achieve these objectives and the willingness to use these tools as necessary. This is very important in order to keep inflation expectations well anchored. If inflation expectations were to become unanchored because the Federal Reserve failed to communicate clearly, this would be a self-inflicted wound that would make our pursuit of the dual mandate of full employment and price stability more difficult. If we at the Federal Reserve can consistently and effectively communicate our objectives and our strategies, we can avoid this outcome. Thank you very much for your kind attention, and I'd be very happy to take a few questions. I see we have some microphones. So, any questions?
Hi, President Dudley. My name is Michael, and I'm a freshman in NYU Stern. It's a great honor for me to have a chance to ask you a question. One of the words that I hear most from what you say just now is about inflation. So my question will be about inflation too. Nowadays, some people argue that the largest exportation of the United States is inflation. And recent quantitative easing policy seem to prove this. And there are some economists who argue that the quantitative easing policy of the Federal Reserve doesn't really help the U.S. economics at all. It just caused a great inflation in emerging markets, and people from on the central banks from the in the emerging markets are already protesting this. So my question will be, what's your thinking about this, that people blame Federal Reserve for the as the culprit of causing inflation in emerging markets? Thank you so much.
I would say that I disagree with that analysis. I strongly disagree with that analysis, in fact. I think that the inflation pressure that we're seeing in emerging market economies is due to the fact that growth in those economies has been very strong, and the demand for commodities, as the urbanization process perceives, has been very, very strong. The fact that U.S. monetary policy is accommodated because the U.S. economy is far away from full employment, I think is completely appropriate for the U.S. And emerging market economies need to see how they can develop policies that result in an appropriate policy regime for them to cope with the pressure that's coming about from the rapid urbanization process. In terms of the large-scale asset purchase program, we think that it actually has been helpful in supporting the U.S. economy. It has resulted in a significant easing of financial market conditions, higher stock prices, narrow credit spreads. And I would note that the outlook for the U.S. economy looks quite a bit better today than it did in August of 2010 when people were beginning to start to anticipate that there might be another large-scale asset purchase program. So I think the problem in terms of emerging market economies is really more a problem of emerging market economies taking on the U.S. stance of monetary policy in terms of how the international monetary regime is constructed. I don't think that the U.S. monetary policy should be held responsible. We have to run a monetary policy in the U.S. that's most consistent with achieving our dual objectives with full employment and inflation. And I would actually point out that us achieving those objectives really is very much in the interest of the entire global economy.
Thank you.
Hi, Roland Marchand, Stern 95. Why would Federal Reserve rates at 25 basis points slow down bank lending if banks can lend at 300, 400, 500, 600 basis points over?
Well, you're absolutely right that if as the economy heals itself and business and household confidence improves, at some point 25 basis points is going to be a rate that's low and attractive, and credit demand is going to start to increase, and the economy is going to grow more rapidly. In fact, right now, that's exactly what we seek. We want to see the economy grow more rapidly, and so we're hoping that a stimulative monetary policy regime, which we have today, will be helpful in that regard. Now, at some point, what we would expect is down the road, the amount of slack in the economy will diminish, credit demand will increase, and at some point down the road, that 25 basis points may be too low, consistent with the amount of credit demand that we will actually want to see to achieve our dual mandate of full employment and price stability. Once we get to the point where we actually can see that as likely happening down the road, we're going to have to anticipate that. And when we anticipate that, we'll raise the interest on excess reserve rate. And by doing that, we will raise the cost of borrowing for people, households, and businesses. And by raising the cost of borrowing, we will affect credit demand, and that will dampen down credit demand and keep the economy from overheating. For years and years, money and banking was taught under the notion that excess reserves led to a rapid expansion of the so-called monetary base, currency and reserves outstanding, and the rapid expansion of the monetary base led to rapid expansion in money supply growth, and rapid expansion of money supply growth inevitably led to inflation, the famous line that that inflation everywhere is a monetary phenomenon. What's changed is the tool that we got in the fall of 2008, the ability to pay interest on excess reserves. We've had very, very rapid growth in the monetary base over the last couple years. We've had virtually no growth in the money supply or in credit demand. There is the linkage between the two right now is not working well. If that linkage starts to restore, then we will raise the interest on excess reserve in order to dampen down credit demand. But right now, the problem of more rapid credit growth is a problem that we would prefer to have than not have, given how much slack there is in the economy.
What is the lag? I'm sure you guys are running a lot of studies, right? Now we're seeing C&I loans are growing, M2 has reaccelerated, and
reaccelerate, I think probably, I'm not sure I would use that word. It's gone from contracting to growing very slowly.
Okay.
But anyway, go ahead.
And QE1 basically was to refinance the balance sheets of the banks, and now they're starting to lend. QE2 will be completed by June. That's 200% of the increase in the monetary base. Historically, we've seen lag effect of maybe 10 months on to CPI. Is that something you agree or disagree with?
Completely disagree in the current environment. One, we have a lot more slack in the economy than we typically do. As I said in my speech, we'd see even if we had 300 jobs per month, which we're not even close to achieving, we would still have quite a bit of slack in the labor market by the end of next year. So, this idea that this is going to happen like fast, I think is very unlikely given the amount of slack we have and the fact that inflation expectations are well anchored. Now, the reason why I'm spending so much time talking about this issue of the monetary base and the linkage to money supply and credit demand is that if people fear this link, that could make inflation expectations higher than they should be. And that would actually make our job more difficult. So it's very important that we at the Fed can convince people that this new tool of paying interest on excess reserves is a viable means of preventing the economy from overheating. I'm absolutely convinced that it is. We've developed a whole bunch of tools just in case, that one out of a million probability that it isn't. So I think that people should be very, very comfortable that we're not going to let inflation get out of hand. Now, it's true that at every business cycle, there's always the question of when does the Fed actually start to tighten, and will they do so in a timely manner? And you know, that question will be on the table, I hope, in this cycle, just like it hasn't been in past cycles. But that problem of deciding when is the appropriate time to tighten, I don't think that's going to be any different in terms of, you know, the issues that the Fed's going to have to wrestle with than it has been in past cycles.
John Hughes, first year MBA. You mentioned earlier the Fed's dual mandate. What is the Fed's plan in a situation where we see increased inflation and do not see the drop in unemployment that would be expected?
Well, obviously, right now, in terms of our dual mandate, the two objectives are not pushing against each other. In other words, inflation is a little bit below what we want, and the unemployment rate's well above what we want. So a monetary policy, an easy monetary policy, is consistent with both objectives. If inflation were to climb, and that were due in a way that we thought that climb was persistent, so it wasn't just short-term commodity price pressure, but something that we thought was going to be more persistent, that would make the monetary policy more complicated, because on one hand we'd be far away from our full employment objective, but we would then have inflation above what we were seeking. If we get to that point, we'll obviously then start putting weight on both objectives. It will make monetary policy more difficult in terms of trying to, modulate in terms of getting back to our dual objectives. But right now we're not in that circumstance. And I think as long as we keep inflation expectations well anchored by being clear that we will exit in a timely way when the time comes, I don't think we're going to have that problem over the near term.
Thank you.
How about one more question? Sure.
Manuela Adol, Stern alumni. May I ask, is the Fed concerned about the current events in the Middle East, and does it think that it will have a long-term impact on what the Fed is doing towards the economic policy in this country?
Well, the policy that we set today is really going to affect the economy sort of with a lag on a pretty long going forward basis. So it's important not to overreact to the near term developments in the Middle East. I think at this point it's highly uncertain how this is going to evolve and what the impact is going to be on oil prices, for example. If oil prices were to go up on a sustained basis, that would make our job more complicated, because oil prices have two effects. One, they dampen real income growth, and so they hurt the economy on the growth side. And two, they raise inflation. So we'll have to sort of see what happens. I think it'd be very premature to make strong judgments today. Well, we don't know exactly how this is going to evolve, how high or how long oil prices will stay high. And it's complicated because of the fact that it has two effects that push in sort of opposite directions. As I said before, I think inflation expectations are really critical here. If you have higher oil prices and they don't feed through into inflation expectations, don't feed through into wage setting, then there's no second round effect, and then therefore I think you can be a little bit more relaxed about the rise in oil prices. In contrast, if oil prices go up and it actually feeds through into inflation expectations and that affects wages and prices, and so you have second round effects, then I think that's something that the Federal Reserve would have to take very, very seriously in terms of how it conducts monetary policy.